David, thanks for joining. It's been quite a while that we've seen each other, and I wanted to ask you kind of a couple of questions where kind of your life experience is pretty unique. You were one of the founders of the Symbian platform, so you've seen what does it take to develop an operating system and then see that operating system in a leading phone back then, in a Nokia phone, for example. And then you've seen that kind of going away, and you've seen Nokia losing market share, etc. And then now we've got Android and iPhone as the two, not only, but the two dominant players. And then our channel is a lot about European competition. How do we get European companies to produce, operating systems that the rest of the world uses? So, I mean, if you would have to rationalize or think about, your experience, how did it happen that you were successful in creating this type of an operating system, and why in the end did we lose ground there?
It's a rich story. And I share your view that there are potential lessons for many other industries. And although that story was in the past, stretching over a period, I guess 30 years altogether, many of the lessons are more timeless. So I can look at the rise and fall of the company I was involved with, Symbian. I can also look at the rise and fall of Nokia, which I worked very closely with, and I have a great admiration for what Nokia managed to achieve. One principle was the principle of collaborating before competing, because Symbian was not made simply by one company, Nokia. It was made by a number of leading phone vendors who already had some experience of the benefits of setting aside some competitive instincts in order to build a shared platform. So Nokia and Ericsson had been leading lights behind the creation of GSM. That's 2G. It goes back many generations, but it was a revolutionary concept at the time that the same wireless network would apply all over large parts of the world, Europe to start off with, and then others. They had cooperated as well on Bluetooth, something we take for granted these days, but it was another revolutionary idea. And they each had explored building an operating system for a more complicated phone, and they had realized this is a tough task. They asked themselves, do they each want to go the route of figuring out how to build a mobile smartphone operating system? And they decided there was benefits to cooperating. And so they looked around, they found the company I was in at the time, Cyan. They liked many of the attributes we prioritized. I'll come back to them in a moment. And that was the basis for them selecting us. And the name Symbian, it comes from the word for symbiosis, partners working together, supporting each other. Another similar word is symphony. It's in music when different instruments combine in a very pleasing way. So, of course, they were competitive. Of course, they kept secrets from each other, but they realized there's a bigger play at work. Now, the thing they were most concerned about, it's a bit funny now to reflect on it, they were concerned about Microsoft doing to the mobile phone industry, much the same as Microsoft had been perceived as doing to the PC industry. In other words, PC manufacturers had comparatively little innovation left to them. It seemed the majority of the revenues went to the chip providers such as Intel and to the software, Microsoft. And Microsoft had a very firm way of working. They laid down clear standards, and there wasn't much flexibility for what the PC manufacturers can do. Nokia, Ericsson, and other initial shareholders like Motorola, later Panasonic, Siemens, Samsung, they wanted much more flexibility to vary their solutions on top of a common platform. So that was the framework. And that was hard work. I don't want to minimize the hard work that was involved. I don't want to tell any simplistic stories that, hey, if you think differently, you will be successful. There was a huge amount of engineering involved at all levels of engineering. Engineering of the design of the user interface, engineering of the test systems, engineering of relationship frameworks for partners cooperating. But we managed to get enough of these working well enough so that in due course, later than we'd hoped, but in due course, we sold 100 million smartphones with our operating system about 8 years into our existence. And then after another short 18 months, we had sold another 100 million. And in 3 more years, we had reached a total of 500 million. So we were successful through a lot of hard work and through a couple of fundamental principles, one of them being cooperate before competing. Another was keep usability in mind at all times. And another one was prioritize robustness and reliability. The software should not crash. It should not use up memory. It should not use too much battery life. And because we kept all that in the forefront, that's why ultimately we were pretty successful for a while.
And then at some point of time, we've got Android and iOS coming in. And then both of those systems, they are Linux derivatives or Linux based or Linux related, right? So how do you see, you know, the competition went on? Because you did have all of the components in place. You had lots of hardware vendors like Sony and Nokia supporting Symbian. So what happened in the last stretch of this story?
Well, one part of it is that there had been many other Linux-based competitors to Symbian over the years. And most of the names are forgotten now. I won't go through all of them. But time and again, there was a worry that Linux would be the basis of a competing operating system. And time and again, these other endeavors failed. Mm-hmm. Because in some ways, Linux wasn't truly suitable in its earlier forms for these smartphones. And because the other initiatives failed to do the hard engineering that we had done, and they tried to make shortcuts. So there was a bit of a complacency which said, oh, Android, yet another Linux platform. That's exactly what we said, yet another Linux platform. They are likely to fail. And indeed, when we read in the news from Andy Rubin, who was the technical genius behind Android working at Google, he expressed in one time, gosh, this is really hard, you know, working with all these different phone manufacturers. We sort of smiled to ourselves and said, yeah, they've got huge efforts to climb. But there's a lesson here. Just because you head off a particular kind of competitor for a long time, you can't be complacent and think you're always going to head them off. And what Google did right, first of all, they prioritize developers much more than Symbian and our partners had done. We always put a lot of effort into looking after developers, but we required them to use what turned out to be fairly non-standard development tools. Whereas with Android, they had a very brilliant initiative, which was to use Java, which Symbian used as well, but they used a much more standard version of Java, whereas we had a cut-down version called Java for mobile devices. They used something much more close to the main enterprise version of Java. They re-implemented it in a very efficient way. So that was a big step up. And I remember when some graduate engineers in Symbian first explored that Java environment on Android, they came back and said, this is gorgeous. This is wonderful. They couldn't contain their fascination by it. So Google targeted developers much more. And by the way, it was the same with Apple in due course. The Apple development tools were largely the same for iOS as it was for building applications for Macs, desktop Macs or laptop Macs. So they put more focus when it mattered into developers. Whereas in the Symbian world, there was always a little bit of ambivalence. There was unclarity as to how important applications really were. And this is an argument, I have to say, I lost within the Symbian camp. I tell that story in my book, Symbian Smartphones and Beyond, the lessons from the extraordinary rise and fall of Symbian. I did argue that we should do more to help developers, but the view was, we've already got lots on our plate. We've got other things we need to do. Developers will see the size of the market, and they'll do whatever it takes to reach a market of 100 million, 200 million, 300 million smartphones. But it was just too hard in many cases because we hadn't done enough to enable more standard usage. Whereas both Android and Apple, they invested more in support of developers, and Apple did something profound. They did a huge effort into their app store. Now, Nokia also believed in an app store. They put a lot of effort in, but they weren't so successful. They weren't so skillful in managing that app store, whereas Apple did it very well indeed. And now the revenues Apple gets from the app store are enormous. They get a cut from that. So they prioritize that. They also changed the game. Apple did things which customers were not asking for. And when I say customers here, the customers of the smartphones, in the first instance, were the network operators, people like Vodafone and Orange and AT&T. And what they often said to Nokia and others was, make your devices smaller. Leave out applications. Applications complicate. Make your devices cheaper. Above all else, make sure you've got the best quality of voice. And Steve Jobs ignored all these pieces of customer input, which is a dangerous advice. I'm sort of suggesting that in some cases, it's appropriate to ignore what your customers are saying. And Jobs, Steve Jobs was right, because he anticipated not the customer's needs, but the needs of the customer's customers. And he had the insight that actually, for the right circumstances, end customers wouldn't mind paying a lot more for the devices. And what he did also was business model innovation. Instead of requiring people to pay a lump sum to cover the entire large cost of these new expensive phones, which had humongous amounts of hardware in them, instead, they had the cost spread out over a long contract period, with the cost being covered by increased data charges. So it was an easier thing for customers to sign up to. So did they do that? Well, too. Now, Nokia foresaw a lot of this. Nokia was visionary. Nokia had a brilliant research team, which anticipated lots of uses. But what ultimately held us up is a kind of debt, not a financial debt, but a technical debt. Maybe this is the last thing I'll mention in this opening remarks, the importance of avoiding technological debt. Financial debt is when you've got big ideas, but you don't have enough money to achieve them. Technological debt is when you've got big ideas, but your technology is too brittle. It's not flexible enough to adapt. So I mentioned that Symbian OS itself was pretty well architected. There were limits, but we did a reasonably good job. But what happened in the subsequent years is that more and more layers were added on the top and the bottom, which lacked some of the same long-term and good architecture. And so shortcuts were made in order to rush out products, and the architecture as a whole became much harder to change. And so although the senior managers of Nokia and Symbian hoped that changes could be added more quickly, in particular, support could be added for pen or for touch. So bear in mind, a lot of Nokia's best-selling smartphones until then had no touch capabilities. Nokia had decided, with some justification, that touch would be a detraction because it would make the screen messier, it would add cost to the device, it would make the screen harder to see, but eventually the hardware of touch capacity improved. And so it was sensible to add touch capabilities on, whereas Nokia had taken that out of the Symbian operating system, or they disabled it. And they thought they could easily add it back. They said it would take 3 months. In reality, it took more like 2 years instead of 3 months. Why? Not because the engineers were poor, but because the system had accumulated too much technological debt and limited their flexibility to move. So one message I will say, which I think is applicable across multiple fields, is take care that your platform doesn't acquire too much spaghetti-like characteristics, which is a kind of informal way of talking about technological debt.
Thank you for this tour de force of, you know, how it happened, right? Because, of course, with the benefit of the hindsight, some of the things become seemingly obvious, right? Even if, you know, we meet the same type of a situation once again, and this is where I want to turn to now, and then, you know, of course, none of this is obvious. For example, if we ask ourselves the question, you know, what could happen with the mobile operating system market in the next, 5-10 years, given that there is a there is an inclination of balkanization of the market in general, and then China may, maybe quite motivated to back up their own operating systems on which they will not be dependent on the others. So what would be your take on that?
So I agree, we can't foresee with confidence, but we should try hard to look at scenarios, and we should explore possible scenarios. So I see four possible factors that could become more and more significant as the 2020s unfold. One of them is that one particular feature of the forum will become more and more central. Just like in the early days of Apple, they showed that the web browser was much more important than had previously been thought. Previously, the web browser was a nice kind of geeky add-on to phones. And the most important thing was you could make wonderful phone calls with it, and you had a few extra apps, messaging and so on. But Steve Jobs' vision, or the vision, I should say, of the whole iPhone team, was that people should have a very enchanting browsing experience. And so they optimized the browsing experience, not for all websites. They missed out support for Flash, which used to be important for lots of websites. So they said, we're not bothering with that. But they had a very good experience with web browsing. And that was one of the reasons why people didn't mind having a poorer voice experience. Actually, the voice experience on the iPhones at first were much poorer than in many other manufacturers. But they said, well, actually, we'd rather have the gorgeous touch experience and browsing. Well, in the same way, one feature of mobile phones may be even more compelling in the next 3 or 4 years and might determine the winners and losers. And that's the quality of the personal assistant, the AI that's there. Mm-hmm. That if you speak to your phone, it will understand what you're trying to do with it. Because many times, I saw it this morning, a family member said to me, why is my mobile phone doing this? And it took me a while to figure out why it was doing it. And I showed, look, there's this obscure thing in here. So why couldn't my family member have just asked the phone itself, please fix this? And why didn't it understand that? So this level of understandability is still not present, but AI is improving very quickly. We might talk more about that later. AI potentially is going to change everything. And the systems that prove themselves to be more easily used for all kinds of people, that they understand exactly what the person's trying to do from just a few words. You know, remember when the web browser, Google, when you started typing a few words and it would autocomplete, this is, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, it was astonishing. How does it know what I'm trying to say? Or sometimes you would put something and it says, did you mean this? Because it knows that people frequently misspell. So there's an intelligence in the interface there. So I think the companies that have the best intelligence in the interface may leave the others behind. And Apple has a dilemma here, because Apple's culture has been one of secrecy, one of not publishing their plans to the outside world, which has stood them well when they are very careful not to announce too many things in advance. But the best AI developers, they like to publish. So Microsoft and Amazon and Google, Alphabet now, and Meta, Facebook, they allow all their AI researchers to publish at least some of what they're doing, whereas Apple struggling with that. And what this might mean is that some of the best AI developers will not want to work at Apple. They'll work elsewhere. And therefore, it might be that Android has a much better interface. That's scenario one. Scenario two, however, is that something else is going to become more important for users of mobile phones. Something we all care about deeply, which is privacy and security. Yeah. It's that people will not be spying on us. People will not be manipulating us. People will not be looking how we are reacting to various websites and use that knowledge to lead us to buy things we probably shouldn't buy or to vote for people we shouldn't vote for and so on. So if a phone manufacturer can truly convince users that this phone is on the side of the user and is not representing big tech or big government or whatever, that might be more important. And this is Apple's play. Apple says we're really on the side of users in a way that Google isn't, because Google's trying to boost advertising revenue. Apple doesn't make money from advertising revenue. It makes money from apps and makes money from hardware. So in that scenario, there's going to be some more disasters with people feeling let down by big tech and saying, which big tech can we really trust? And the company that does that might succeed. Scenario three is a different kind of application might become really significant, which is healthcare apps. Now, we've had limited success so far with watches that measure your heart rate and your stress and so forth, but they're sort of still marginal. You know, they've saved people's lives, but they're not so important. But perhaps when a company really gets this right, and now we will all say to each other, hey, wear your smart bracelet connected to your smartphone or whatever it is, this will be the big difference in giving you guidance as to how to live a more healthy life. Perhaps that will be the breakthrough. So health could be the killer app. And finally, on this run, maybe it's going to be virtual and augmented reality. Maybe we are going to finally all wear Google Glass. You know, Google Glass failed for all kinds of reasons we could talk about. But at some stage, they're going to be good enough. And we're going to revert to having people with eyeglasses because they can, in principle, be so useful. And maybe the company that gets that right, that's suddenly going to flip. So we're no longer going to say, oh, whose mobile phone are you using? It's going to be, oh, whose smart glasses are you using? Or whose virtual or augmented reality gateway are you using? So there are four possible scenarios for the next 5 years of mobile phones or so. And I didn't even pick up the suggestion you threw me at the beginning, which was, what about the clash between Chinese-based operating systems and the non-Chinese? Or even, what about the European operating systems? Because there's nothing, no sign of anything, is there? Oh, the few that Nokia or ex-Nokia people were developing are still relatively minor. Is it Sailfish, MIMO? I forget what they're called. They're quite cute. Cute isn't quite the right, that's the disparaging word. They are capable, but they're left behind because there are much larger forces behind the juggernauts of iOS and Android. Enormous resources are going into these operating systems that aren't matched by any of the genuinely open source initiatives.
And if we kind of switch from mobile world into AI, as you also alluded to, and then try to go into the foresight mode and then try to understand, you know, what are those possible scenarios of how ability of European companies to create AI systems as compared to US and Chinese companies, right? Because just like as we don't have European mobile operating systems, we don't really have European cloud vendors, right? Even if we have, you know, pretty strong European application artificial intelligence companies, right? So how do you see, you know, the role that European companies play and in this sphere?
One thing that some Europeans are saying with some plausibility is that the whole industry is going to need better standards. It's going to need better regulations. It's hard to get it right, but it comes back to this point about trusting and security and privacy. You know, if there is some better guarantee that the AI systems are not going to cause damage, they're not going to manipulate people, they're not going to deceive people, they're not going to run riot with fake news, then maybe people will say, let's use this platform rather than that capable but dangerous platform over there. So the EU Parliament has set forth a number of acts. It started off with GDPR. It's doing a Data Act, an EU AI Act. There's also a Services Act and Market Act. And they're trying to set the framework within which the rest of the world will be obliged to operate. But this is hard because it's easy to be counterproductive with regulations. Remember when motor cars started off, at least in Britain, you needed a man with a red flag walking in front of the car to warn off people who might be alarmed by it. And that slowed down the motor industry for a bit. Maybe that's why in the end, German motor manufacturers and Italian motor manufacturers are more successful than British. That's just one speculation. Apparently, it was members of the British Parliament who had shares in railways, and railways were sort of worried by this newfangled competition for motor cars. So they were quite interested in slowing down. And it's the same sadly, I mean, this looks like a bit of a detour, but it's actually similar principles. Often
Pretty relevant.
regulations are used to fight off potential innovation and disruption. So there are dangers in the EU putting together a framework which might mean that more innovation happens elsewhere. So instead of Europe winning through having the best regulations, it will mean that there's even less innovation in Europe. So this is a big, hard question. I don't think we should duck it. I think there needs to be a lot of careful thought. I think GDPR is partially successful. Some of the things it's done are very good to prevent people's data being used without their permission. That's important. To give people the right to query when an algorithm has been used to make a decision against them. The right to be forgotten, that's also important. But a lot of the practicality is hard. It comes back to my point earlier about engineering. You know, there's a lot of devil in the details. And if you try to ignore the technical details, if you just apply some fine-sounding high principles from a legal perspective, you may end up with something that's worse than the problem you're trying to solve.
Absolutely. And you've had a very good podcast last week where from the London Futurist Club members, where you dive into the proposed European Union legislation around artificial intelligence, right? And we will put a link to our listeners here. How do you see that, in Europe, European companies should structure thinking around AI? You know, is it a strategic resource which you cannot have outside of your own firm? Is it something that you should rely on other firms providing to you? And then similarly, you know, should we make sure that there is enough of AI engineering and mathematical ability within the borders of European Union or Europe more widely? Or is it something that we can rely on others delivering us? Also going back to the COVID experience, when we understood that, you know, sometimes it really helps that the mask producer is somewhere within your shores.
So we come to the topic of the key skill of collaboration, which involves recognizing you can't do everything by yourself. It involves figuring out reliable partnerships, but also it involves having enough expertise inside your company as well, so that you're not utterly dependent on partners that ultimately you cannot control. And if you don't have enough internal knowledge, you can easily be led astray. You can go with a partner that sounds convincing, but actually, and if you had more insight, you should have chosen differently. So yes, everybody needs to learn about AI. And when I say everybody, I mean everybody, not just for business reasons. We're all going to be affected by AI personally too, in our entertainment, in how we socialize, in the health care that we experience, and so on. So all of us owe it to ourselves to go beyond naive Hollywood science fiction understanding of AI, to go beyond an understanding of AI that might have been true in 2010, but which has long been overtaken by the rise of deep neural networks, and to go beyond an understanding of AI that might have been true in 2020, but which in turn has been superseded by another big bang wave with transformers and generative AI, in which these systems are no longer dependent so much on annotated data to learn, but they can learn in a self-supervised mode in which their capability is expanding. So everybody owes it to themselves to understand AI more than they do already. And it's probably worth tracking down on YouTube or whatever some suitable podcast or videos that can help you to understand it a bit more. And it's useful talking about it with others too. So this is something everybody needs, and companies need some in-house AI expertise too. And they should not be led astray just by people who knew about AI 10 or even 3 or 4 years ago. I have to say, I often listen to people whose job title is head of AI. And frankly, they don't understand AI, or they don't have an up-to-date understanding of AI. Sad to say, because the field is changing a lot. So we need to be able to pick people whose knowledge stays up to date. And maybe that's a key skill worth underlining as well. to be able to keep on learning new things, to unlearn, and where appropriately to relearn, because otherwise you will still coast along on what was true 3 or 4 years ago, and you will be really out of date in your advice. So you need to find people who have got that knowledge, but we can't do it all by ourselves. So we must try to engineer a world in which our overseas partners still wish and want to treat us as partners and rather to exploit us. So the likelihood is we will be using systems that are largely originating outside Europe, but we should be able to structure long-term relationships, and then we should be able to add value on top. And it may not be the same kind of value that other people are adding, but there might be something else that can be done in healthcare, in chemistry. I spoke recently, it's in another one of my podcasts, to one of the most senior executives of IBM, Alessandro Curioni, based in Zurich. And he talked about IBM's project, largely done in Europe, which was to have a model for organic chemistry, a bit like the large language text models. So these large language text models built by Transformers, as I mentioned, have a great understanding of language. And if you give them a few sentences, they can predict what a good follow-up will be. Well, if you apply much of the same things to organic chemistry, if you train it with enough organic chemistry reactions, in the same way, it can start to predict the outcomes of organic chemical reactions that have never taken place before. And this refers also to a different European group, the DeepMind group in the UK, which again is part of an organization headquartered overseas in America, Alphabet, Google's Alphabet. But what they did there is they, with a different technology, they work out in advance how proteins are going to fold.
Yes.
And remarkable, truly remarkable, a long outstanding problem in science. So that's a different aspect of chemistry. We might even say biochemistry, more organic chemistry. So it may be that companies in Europe can identify an area which has not been fully developed yet, and part of science perhaps, and win there rather than trying to be the general platform provider.
Thank you. Thank you, David. Thank you for sharing the insights, and let's stay in touch, and then we will also help our viewers to find your YouTube and podcast locations.
It's a pleasure. It's a big subject.
It is a big subject.
I do recommend people don't give up on this subject. Keep looking at it.